What was original sin? And was there really a talking snake in the Garden of Eden? We'll look at those questions on this week's episode of the Faith by Reason podcast. Welcome to the podcast. The website behind it all is faithbyreason.net. There you will find the blog and this podcast and a ton of great information, so please check it out. Now, we are on a new series. This is actually the second podcast in a new series on the dispensations. The dispensations are God's contrastive way of proving that his plan for humanity is the only one that will work. Now, when I say dispensations, don't get caught up in dispensationalism, that doctrine. I'm not necessarily a dispensationalist. I don't believe everything that dispensationalists believe, but I'm using the term because it's a familiar term. So each one of these dispensations, they're a period of time where God deals with man, deals with humanity in a different way in order to give man every opportunity to choose God's plan on his own, even though man likely will not. So in each one of these periods of time, in each one of these dispensations, God gives man the opportunity to either choose God or to choose himself. And God does this because he's righteous. And you can go back to the earlier podcast on how to be right and righteousness to understand what we're talking about when we go into the dispensations and about God being right and why God would do that through contrastive thinking and a contrastive process. So in the last podcast, we began looking at the very first dispensation, the so-called dispensation of innocence. This was a time when man had no knowledge of good and evil. Man was completely innocent, and God gave him that first opportunity to choose himself or to choose God. And we looked at the creation of the first man and the first woman, and we looked at Eden, and we discovered that Eden was not just a garden. Yes, there was obviously the Garden of Eden, but Eden was more than just a garden. The garden was planted east in Eden, meaning that there was at least a western part of Eden, if not a northern part and a southern part. And another portion of Eden, if not the remainder of Eden, was a mountain. So there was the Garden of Eden, and there was a mountain, and we know there was at least those two regions. And the important thing about that mountain, it was called the Mountain of Assembly. Who was assembling there? Well, not just Adam and Eve, but all of God's spiritual representatives, his divine counsel, to use the terminology of Dr. Michael Heiser, whose book we talked about in the last podcast. So you had these angelic beings who were in Eden along with God and along with Adam and Eve. And so it's pretty safe to assume that Adam and Eve interacted with these very powerful spiritual angelic beings in addition to God. And that's going to be very important when we talk about the so-called serpent in the garden. We also know that Adam and Eve were made in the image of God. And again, that doesn't mean that they looked like God, that God has arms and legs and hair. It means they were God's image bearers, meaning they were God's representatives on earth. When God created the world in 7 days, he created the world in 6 days. On the seventh day, he rested, not because he was tired, but because what that terminology means is that he ceased to be the first cause. He rested from his role as the first cause. He does not cause anything anymore. Now he reacts to it, and he gave that authority of being the first cause to men and women, and Adam and Eve specifically, and they were essentially his representatives, his image bearers. They bore his image on earth, meaning they had his authority on earth. God gave Adam and Eve the authority. We read about that in Genesis 1 and 2, where he says, you know, the earth is yours, go and subdue it and make it your own. And basically their job was to turn the rest of the earth into Eden as God's representatives. So they were the kings and queens. They were the king and queen of the earth, and they were to bear children who would also be the kings and queens of the earth. That should have been what happened. But of course, as we well know, that's not what happened because of original sin. So how did we get to the point of original sin? Well, it starts with that choice that God had to give man to either choose God or choose himself, and he had to give him a rule. And that rule that he gave to the first man and woman was around the... Now, they were allowed to eat... Their food was fruit. They could eat the fruit of any tree in the garden, which of course means that Adam and Eve were vegans, which means they were annoying because all vegans are annoying. Okay, I'm going to go off on a tangent for just a second here, because vegans, they are such annoying, arrogant people. I happen to live in an area that there's a lot of very health conscious people, very into fitness, which is nothing wrong with that. In fact, there's everything right with that. But you can take anything to an extreme, and vegans do that. They go way too far, and they are always in your face, and they're always so self-important about what they feel about food and meat and whatnot. So before I go to work, I always like to get a cup of coffee. Actually, a latte. I love lattes. A latte is an espresso with milk. And so I was ordering my latte one day, and I asked for milk, and I asked, you know, for regular milk. They asked, you want soy milk, almond milk, or regular milk? And I was like, I want regular cow's milk. So there's a woman behind me who happens to be a vegan. How do I know that? Because she told me pretty quickly that she was a vegan. And after I ordered my latte, she turns to me. She says, why didn't you order that with soy milk? I said, well, for a couple reasons. Number one, soy milk has estrogen in it, and I don't want to grow breasts. And secondly, soy milk tastes like crap. It tastes like liquid cardboard. I don't want that. So that's why I don't order soy milk with my latte. And she says, well, you know, I'm a vegan. Of course you are. You just told me. And I believe that soy milk is healthier, and or almond milk is healthier for you. Because do you know that human beings are the only animal that drinks the milk of other animals? Like, well, yeah, but I think that's not because animals don't want to drink the milk of other animals. It's because they can't. Human beings are the only animal, and we're not animals. Human beings are the only creatures that can drink the milk of other animals because we have opposable thumbs and we can milk animals. I'm sure a squirrel would love to have some cow milk, but what is he going to do? Try to suckle from the cow? The cow would kick the crap out of him. So it's not because animals don't want to drink. I mean, if I took a bowl of milk and put it in front of my dog wouldn't turn his nose up at it and say, oh, I don't want that. No, my dog would drink it up and be like, oh my God, this is amazing. Why haven't you given me this before? And those of you who own cats, which is unfortunate because cats are evil, but you know, you give your cat milk. Cats like cow's milk. Animals would happily drink the milk of other animals. It's not because they don't want to, it's because they don't know how to do it. Human beings have that ability. You know what else human beings are the only creatures that we're the only creatures that drive cars and ride in airplanes and have computers and have gone to the moon. God, vegans are ridiculous. But anyway, I'm sorry, I got way off topic there. So Adam and Eve, they only ate fruit, so they were vegans. Hopefully they weren't annoying vegans. And they probably weren't, because they had no one else to criticize for eating meat. So they were probably okay. But they were not allowed to eat from this one tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And God said, in the day that they did so, they would die. So it's a, you know, pretty clear instructions. You eat all the other fruit you want, you live. You eat the tree, you eat the fruit of this tree, you die. So that was the one rule God gave them. And if they broke that rule, well, that would obviously lead to original sin, or at least partially. And we'll get into that pretty soon. So we of course know that they broke this rule. It's a very familiar story. Genesis chapter 3 is extremely familiar. We all know the story of Adam and Eve and the forbidden fruit. And this is where we start. The thing is, whenever we have a story that we're familiar with or anything we're familiar with, sometimes we start to lose some resolution because we are so familiar with the story, or at least we think we are. We start to take certain things for granted and we don't give it a close examination. And when we do that, we miss some very important things. And I think that there are some very important things in this Eden narrative that Christians miss. And I think we're going to have the opportunity to go over some of them in this podcast and maybe the next one, depending on how much time I have left on this one. Okay, so let's get started. What was the circumstance under which the original sin happened, under which they ate from the tree? Well, that's where we get to the so-called talking snake. So I'll give you a quick paraphrase of, I'm not going to read Genesis 3, I'll just give you a paraphrase of what happened in Genesis 3. And it starts and it says, you know, that the serpent, or in the Hebrew word, nachash, was more clever than any animal, any more subtle, more intelligent than any other animal in the field, or any animal in the field. And it came up to Eve and it had a conversation with her. And the serpent, the nachash, said to Eve, hey, you know, did God say you couldn't eat of you could eat of all these trees in the garden? And Eve said, well, yeah, you know, God said we could eat of any tree in the garden, but you know, the tree in the middle of the garden, with the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, we can't eat that one because on that day we'll die. And the nachash said, the serpent said, no, that's not going to happen. See, God's holding out on you. See, God knows that if you eat of that tree, your eyes will be open and you will know good from evil. You'll be just like the gods. The serpent did say gods. He didn't say you will be like God. He said you will be like gods, plural, little g, knowing good and evil. And that was it. That was the whole spiel of the so-called serpent. And then Eve thought about it and she said, oh, well, you know, this this fruit here is nice looking, it looks like delicious fruit, and it'll make me wise, it'll make me like the gods, well, then I think I'll take a bite. So she took a bite of it. She gave some to Adam, and the Bible says Adam was with her. We'll get into what that means in a few minutes. And he ate of it, and that was that. That was the original sin. They broke the rule, right? Well, let's take a deep dive into this, starting with the serpent. Was this really a talking snake? Was this a snake slithering around and just had the ability to talk and reason and deceive Eve? Now, in the blog post that is related to this, I'm pretty diplomatic about the blog post is called Paradise Lost in the First Dispensation. I'll have it linked in the show notes. I'm diplomatic about the identity of the serpent. I say, well, maybe it was a snake, maybe it wasn't, and here's what I think it might have been. I'm not going to be as diplomatic here because this, the podcasts are a bit more informal, and I will tell you it was not a snake. I will say this again: this was not a reptilian, fang-having, belly-slithering snake. It was not. It was, in fact, the malevolent, evil entity we call the devil and Satan, who was originally known as Lucifer. And I have quite a bit of information on him. On the blog, you can go into the category of Satan and read all about him. It was not a snake. It was not Satan pretending to be a snake or speaking through a snake. It was just Satan in all of his quote-unquote glory. How do we know that? Well, before I get into my reasons for why it's pretty obvious biblically and logically that this was not a talking snake, but it was actually Satan himself, I'm going to give the opposing view first, because there are people, some people who I even respect, who still believe it was somehow a snake who happened to talk. Now, what would this mean? Well, it would mean that if this were true, then this serpent was intelligent. It means it had to be more intelligent than Eve. Why? Because it deceived her. You can't be deceived by someone who is dumber than you. And now I know some people say that animals have intelligence, some do, some are smarter than others. But this serpent, this snake, would have had to have been so intelligent that it would have been beyond Eve. And that's kind of something that I don't think is biblically true, because human beings were the height of God's physical creation. Yet people who believe that this was just a snake would have you believe that even though God, it's clear that humans are the height of his creation, his physical creation, somehow this snake was smarter than Eve, and that doesn't make any sense. They would also say that before the snake was cursed, and we'll talk about the curses that go along with original sin a bit later, but apparently it was a biped. It had arms and legs and it could walk around, and part of the curse said it would go on its belly for the rest of its days. So you have a snake that was smart, that was a biped. Some people even say that perhaps the snake was originally like a dinosaur. This is how the dinosaurs died out. God cursed them. Okay, well, let's talk about why that doesn't make sense. First of all, the curse about going on its belly, and that is really the only part of the curse that you could possibly relate to a snake. That's fine, but the Bible doesn't say that part of the curse was that the snake would lose its intelligence if it had it. So, I mean, wouldn't that be the most important thing? Because the most important thing about this snake, the thing that, if it was a snake, the thing that was what was its defining characteristic was its intelligence. So if when God cursed it, wouldn't God have said, you're going to be dumb from now on, you're going to have the brain of a pea? No, that's not. God just said you're going to go on your belly, and it said there'll be enmity between you and the woman, and between her your seed and her seed. And there's nothing that about snakes that give them some kind of special enmity towards women. That doesn't happen. If a snake has a chance to bite a man or a woman, it doesn't say, you know what, which one should I choose? Oh, yeah, the woman. I hate her. No, that doesn't happen. So it also says that the curse said that the snake would eat dust. Snakes don't eat dust. We know that. And again, I'm going to get into the curses a little bit more later. But this was not a snake. This was Satan. This was the devil. How do I know that? Well, let's look at the word that's translated serpent. I mentioned before, the word is nachash in Hebrew. That word nachash, if you look it up in your concordance, you will see that the very first definition of it does say a serpent, a snake. However, if you get down a little deeper, if you keep going down to the etymology of the word, if you look at the next part of the root, it says that nachash means the enchanter or the deceiver. Okay, now we're getting a little bit closer. Now, if you go even further down to the very bottom of it, and I'm going to say, I have a link in this to another website that's about a book called The Great Inception, which it seems to be a pretty good book. I haven't read it myself, but the person who did the book has a blog as well, and he talks about this in detail, and I'm going to link it there because it's some good reading. But what it's saying is that when you get down to the root, the very root of the word Nakash, it means the shining one. If you have it as a proper noun, the Nakash is a proper noun in Genesis chapter 3, the Nakash is called the shining one. That should be the proper interpretation. It should say that the shining one was more clever, more intelligent than any animal, any beast of the field. And understand also that it does not say it was more. In the original language, it does not say that the Nakash was more clever than any other animal. It wasn't comparing it to animals. It was actually contrasting it with animals. It was actually, I think Moses, who the physical writer of Genesis, was contrasting the Nakash, the shining one, to animals to prove that it was not an animal. And there was a really good reason for that, which we're going to get into in just a second. So Nakash means the shining one, the glowing luminescent one. And what was Satan's original name? It was Lucifer. And what does Lucifer mean? Lucifer means the light bringer, the shining one. This was Satan. Now, I will admit, and granted, through the concordance, we can see that Nakash eventually came to mean serpent or snake. And why would it come to mean that? Well, in order to understand that, let's look at some characteristics of Satan that will help us understand why Nakash went from meaning the shining one to actually being the vernacular migrated to have it mean serpent, to mean snake. Now, we know that Satan, when he was Lucifer, he was the pinnacle of angelic creation. He was the top angel, the number one angel. He was called the anointed cherub that covereth. He was the ultimate angel. And again, he was a cherub. Now, when you think of the word cherub or look at the word cherub, you have to get rid of the image of from the medieval and Renaissance level art that shows cherubs as these little chubby male babies with little tiny wings. That's a complete fabrication. That has nothing to do with a cherub. When you look at the description of cherubs in the Bible, in Ezekiel, and I'll have a link in the show notes to that, and in some of the other places, they are actually some pretty fearsome creatures. These cherub or cherubim, which is a plural, were the top angels. Satan was the number one angel, and the next level down were the cherubs. And he was one of the, she was a top cherub, and the cherubs were the top angels. The cherubim were the top angels. They were the most powerful angels. And there had to be five of them. Four of them didn't fall. Four of them remained holy. And one of them, Lucifer, fell. So let's look at these other cherubim and see what we can glean from them. And they are in Revelation chapter 4 and 5. They are described, among other things, as one of them had the face of a man. One of them was like a soaring eagle. The other was like an ox or a cow. And the fourth was like a lion. So you had man, eagle, lion, and cow representing humanity, representing all of God's living things that they had authority over, representing God's physical creation. Man, you had carnivores represented by the lion. You had herbivores represented by the ox or the cow. And you had avians or birds represented by the eagle. Well, if you look at all the creation, all the physical creation, there's one missing. There's one set of animals missing, and that's the animals that are cold-blooded and scaly. We're talking about fish and reptiles. They are not represented there, and they're left out. But it kind of makes sense when you look at the fact that there's also a cherub left out. There is the fifth cherub, the fallen cherub, who is Lucifer. So it would stand to reason that Lucifer, when he was in his holy state, or maybe still does to a degree, he represented that form of life, reptilian life, and animals with scales. And that's not just my conjecture. Many times when Lucifer or the devil is talked about in the Bible, he is talked about as using reptilian characteristics. He's called the Great Red Dragon. He's called that several times throughout the book of Revelation and elsewhere in the Bible. He is referred to as a dragon. A dragon is a gigantic reptile. I believe that Satan had reptilian features. And even if you look in some of the satanic idolatry in areas like ancient Egypt or even in North America and some of the ancient gods there, that you have these flying, shining, plumed serpents. These serpents, these reptilian type creatures are worshipped as gods and worshipped as the chief of the gods was usually a reptilian, serpentine sort of creature, sort of idol. And so because Satan has that reptilian, those reptilian characteristics to him, eventually the word Nahash, a shining one, through migration of vernacular, came to mean serpent. And became so, and Satan became so ubiquitously tied to his reptilian aspects that the vernacular migrated to where Nahash meant serpent, meant snake, and it got to the point where it was such a part of the vernacular that when Moses was writing the book of Genesis to the Israelites, he needed to contrast the Nahash, the shining one, with serpents, because they called serpents Nahash. Yeah, he had to contrast it with him with animals so that they would not think he was talking about a regular old garden snake. And so how does that vernacular migration happen? Well, you know, I'll give you a couple of real world examples. First one would be the company called Xerox. Xerox is well known for making copy machines. Now, we pretty much take that for granted now. Copy machines are everywhere. Every office has a copy machine. Even here in my home office, I have my own copy machine. But when they were first introduced, I guess in the late 60s, early 70s or whatever, they were a big deal. Before you had copy machines, if you wanted to duplicate a document or a report or a book, you'd have to do it by hand. You have to write it by hand, or you have to type it out by hand. And that could take, you know, hours, maybe even days, depending on the volume. But with a copy machine, you can push a button and you suddenly have it in a matter of seconds or minutes. It revolutionized office work. Now, in one of my first jobs out of college, actually, I was still in college, it was an internship I had at an office. And the person who I worked for, he was kind of an old school guy, and he talked in old school ways. And my job there as an intern, I was really just doing, you know, menial office work and doing tasks for him. And one of the main tasks I had was copying stuff. He would always ask me to go copy things, but he wouldn't say, you know, go copy something. He would say, hey, can you go Xerox this for me? Why did he say that? Well, I mean, there were many copy machine makers out there. You know, there was Canon and Epson and there were other companies, but Xerox, through their ingenuity and their marketing, became so ubiquitously tied to copying that if it got to the point where if you had a copier, you probably had a Xerox. And Xerox went from being a company, which is what it was, to being a verb for copying things. He would tell me to go Xerox stuff. So again, the vernacular migrated from the Xerox being a company to actually being the act of copying. And I'll give you an even more modern example. The company Google. Google is a company in Northern California, and they're most well known for their search engine. Now, when search engines were first coming into prominence in the mid-late 90s, there were lots of search engines. There was Lycos, there was Yahoo, there was AOL, there was Ask Jeeves. There was a ton of search engines. But then in the late 90s, Google was formed, and the algorithm of the people who invented Google was so much better than the others that they made searching much more efficient, and they came to dominate the world of search, and the other companies pretty much went out of business, to the point now that Google became so ubiquitously tied to the act of searching that instead of saying, when you want somebody to search for something on the web, what do you say? You ask them, well, hey, can you Google this? Now, again, Google is not the act of searching. Google is a company, but it's become so ubiquitously tied to the act of searching because of the dominant search engine that it's now become a verb. To Google something means to do a web search for it. So the vernacular migrates. Same thing with Nahash. Nahash meant shining one, but because the shining one, Lucifer, became so closely associated with serpents and reptiles that Nahash migrated to mean serpent. So that's why when you look in your concordance, you will see that Nahash says serpent. And we're also victimized, in a degree, I don't mean that we're actually victims, but we have fallen victim to the artwork that we see in our Sunday school books and in popular culture of this picture of a snake wrapped around the tree, handing an apple, and it wasn't an apple, we don't know what kind of fruit it was, handing an apple to Eve. That image is in our head, and we've taken it to mean that there is there was a serpent, a snake in the garden doing all this work, and it was not a serpent. It was the devil. It was Satan. So what was Satan's goal? Why did he want to do this? Well, we know about his nature. If you, again, go to the category of Satan on the blog, you can read all about him. But in short, and we'll do the series on Satan later, but in short, he was jealous of the position that man had. Man, you know, the meaning of life is for man to be with God and be like God. That's a position that will be above all angels, all angelic beings, including Lucifer slash Satan. And he didn't like that. And he wanted to facilitate man's fall. So what he did was he went to Eve. Satan, you have to understand some of his strategies. He does not attack you in your strengths. He will attack you in your weaknesses. He will attack you where you are most weak and vulnerable. That's why he didn't go after Adam. Adam got the order not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil from God. Eve got that knowledge from Adam. So he goes to Eve instead. And I don't even think, again, as I just said, in the artwork, we always see Adam and Eve standing by the tree with the snake handing them the apple. Well, that's art, but there's no reason to believe that they were anywhere near the tree when Lucifer tempted her. And again, I think it's important to keep in mind that it would not have been a big deal for her to talk to an angelic being. Now, if she had spoken to us, if it was really a snake, that would have been a big deal because snakes can't talk. Snakes don't have big brains. Snakes are dumb. Their reptiles are not very bright. So he would have said, well, what is this serpent doing talking? That's why I reject the idea that Satan even possessed a snake. What sense does that make? Why would he possess a snake and have that talk to Eve? Like, that would be weird. I mean, that would be less weird than him talking to her when she was used to talking to angelic beings because they were on the mountain of assembly. Eden was a mountain and a garden, and on that mountain were angelic beings who they interacted with. So this was no big deal for Eve. So I believe that Satan got her, she was off walking by herself someplace away from Adam because he didn't want Adam anywhere near that. And that's why, even though it says that Eve was with her husband when she offered him the fruit, I think that happened later. I think that the temptation happened, then Eve had some time to think about it, and then she went with Adam to the tree. So Adam was with her during the actual eating of the fruit, but he was not with her when Satan was tempting her. I think he would have stopped her. I'm not letting Adam off the hook. I'm just saying that he gets a really bad rap when people assume that Genesis chapter 3 all happened in a matter of minutes, and I don't think there's any reason to believe it was. I believe that that's likely that Satan got Eve alone somewhere. She was by herself, and hey, here comes, it's angelic being who she's used to talking to them, and he says to her, for the first thing he does, he just probes a little bit. See, Satan can't make you do, he can't make you do anything. The only thing he can do is throw some temptations at you. He can ask you questions and get you to reveal your weaknesses. And that's what he did with Eve. He asked her a question to reveal her weakness. And he said, hey, did God really say that you couldn't eat from any tree of the garden? Just technically an innocent question. And what did Eve say? Eve said, we can eat of any tree, but we can't eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And we can't touch it. That's important. We talked about this in the very, very first podcast, that was the first act of religion. Religion, and we'll get into religion, down the road a bit, actually in about three podcasts from now. Religion is when man's effort to improve upon God's plan, among other things. Religion is man's attempt to be godly on his own, not by obeying what God says, but basically by improving on God's plan. So Eve was improving on the instruction not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil by saying you can't even touch it. And when Satan heard that, he said, okay, I got you. That's your weakness. Your weakness is religious pride. You want to be like God on your own. That's why you added something to his rule. So as soon as he saw that, he said, okay, here's how I get to you, Eve. I'll tell you not only, you want to be like God? Well, here's how you be like God. See, when you eat the fruit, you'll be just like the gods, knowing good and evil. Now, the gods, G-O-D-S, small G-O-D-S, is very important because he didn't say he would be like God. He said he would be like the gods. Who was he talking about? He's talking about the other Elohim. And those other Elohim were the angels, the divine assembly. If you look at Psalm 82, you will see that God's small g is a title for the ruling angels, for that divine council. And that's a whole other thing that we'll get into down the road when we talk about angels and fallen angels. But he's really telling her, you will be like us, like the divine council. And at the time, they were on a higher level than Adam and Eve. So Satan appealed to her religious pride and her desire to be like the gods. And again, then he left. He left it up to Eve after that. He was out of the picture. So I believe Eve thought about it for a while. She contemplated it. Then she went to the tree of knowledge of good and evil with Adam, who was with her at the time, and she ate of the tree. And then she gave it to him, and he ate. He was with her at the time. He was not with her when Lucifer was there, when Satan was there. That would not have been smart on Satan's behalf, because, you know, Adam could have been an authority figure. So he wanted to have Eve be tempted at her most vulnerable point. And then again, he left, and he left her to her own devices. And that's when she ate of the fruit. Now, again, Adam doesn't get off the hook for this. Why did Adam eat of the fruit? The Bible says that Eve was deceived. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, I believe verse 14, it says that Eve was deceived. Adam was not. Adam was not deceived. Adam willingly ate of the fruit. Why would he? Eve, you know, again, they're not letting Eve off the hook either, but she was tricked. She ate the fruit. She's like, uh-oh, this isn't what I thought was going to happen. So why did Adam eat it? He ate it intentionally, knowing. When Eve ate the fruit, she didn't think she was going to die. Adam knew that he was going to die when he ate it. Why did he do it? I believe, and again, this is a little bit of conjecture on my part, but I think it's logical conjecture, that when Eve ate of the fruit, something happened to her spiritually that Adam could discern. And I think Adam knew that she was spiritually dying. And Adam had a choice to make. Adam could choose to continue to be in his current state, knowing that this woman who God gave him, who he loved, was dying, or he could choose to be with her. See, I think Adam loved Eve so much that he chose to join her in death than to live in eternity without her. Now, again, that's a very, very romantic, but it's also pretty stupid. Yeah, romance often is. But again, he said, I would rather, you know, die with you than live without you. And again, very romantic, but he made the wrong choice. And I realize now that I am going over time, I'm past the half hour mark, so I apologize for that. I really wanted to get more into original sin, but it'll have to wait until the next podcast. And we're going to talk about what happened, what the ramifications were, and why eating the fruit was only part of original sin. And I don't even think it was the most important part. I think the most important part of original sin was not eating the fruit. I think it was what happened immediately after they ate the fruit. Why? Because God didn't immediately judge them when he confronted them about eating the fruit. He asked them questions. And the answers to those questions that God asked them in Genesis 3, I think that is the really main part of original sin and how humanity failed that first dispensation. So we're going to have to cut it off here. Sorry, I went a little longer. Probably a stupid vegan story didn't help. So we're going to have to get into this next time. And so thank you for listening to the podcast. I appreciate it. Please subscribe to the podcast. You can do it through the blog, which is my preferred way, through faithbyreason.net, or you can do it through iTunes or Google Play or Stitcher or TuneIn or a bunch of other ways. Just look at the options right below the podcast you're listening to, and you can find other ways to subscribe to it. And please also subscribe to the blog. And we will talk to you next week when we wrap up this little mini series on original sin, and that'll lead us to some very important ramifications for the rest of human history. All right, talk to you next week.